After more than six decades, Cuba will no longer be led by a Castro.
This is Cuba, where it's usually a one man who does, moves, change things.
But that one person won't be named Castro. Which way could Cuba go? Also today, China is relentless in its crackdown on democracy in Hong Kong. Many activists won't stop their fight, though, underground and in exile, keeping the fire burning for democracy back in the territory.
Hong Kong has shown a steady process of making fools of forecasters.
And 50 years ago this week, ping pong diplomacy brought the U.S. and China closer together.
It was the front cover of Time magazine. It was the Johnny Carson show. The ping pong players were everywhere. They were the story in America.
When the whole planet watched table tennis, I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is good to have you with us on this Friday. We begin with news out of Russia. Yesterday, the Biden administration slapped sanctions on the Kremlin. This afternoon, Moscow responded. The World's Daniel Hoffman has been following the story for us and gets us going today. Daniel, just remind us of the volleys in this back and forth. What were some of the measures the U.S. put in place yesterday, and how is Russia now responding?
Well, since President Biden has come into office, his administration said that they would review what they call malign activity from the Russian government. And yesterday was the day when they announced robust sanctions against Russia. And that included sanctions against Russia's economy. That included kicking out 10 Russian diplomats from Washington, some of which the Biden administration said were intel agents. And they also sanctioned 32 entities and individuals who the Biden administration say attempted to influence the 2020 presidential election.
So what is Russia now doing in response?
So from Russia's perspective, this is tit for tat. So Russia is going to expel 10 American diplomats from Moscow. Russia will sanction 8 members of the Biden administration personally. Finally, Russia is saying that it wants John Sullivan, the U.S. ambassador to Russia, to go back to Washington for, quote, consultation.
The U.S. and Russia have long been at loggerheads, Daniel. Can you sum up how the relationship got to this low point?
Well, we could go as far back as the Obama administration. Remember, when Obama came into office, they tried a so-called reset with Russia, with the Kremlin, and that didn't quite work out because of a number of factors, one of which was Russia invading Crimea in 2014 and illegally annexing the peninsula and also leading to a war in eastern Ukraine. And that was followed in 2016 with Russia meddling in the U.S. elections. So many of these themes linger in addition to some other malign activity that the Biden administration says Russia is responsible, including hacks and other influence campaigns. So with all of that lingering, the tensions are only rising, which has led to the sanctions we saw yesterday and now the counter sanctions that we're seeing from Russia today.
Right, and very little correction to the relationship under Trump. What kind of pathway forward is there now for the U.S.-Russia relationship?
Well, earlier this week, President Biden did call Russian President Vladimir Putin in part to say that the U.S. stands with Ukraine and supports Ukrainian sovereignty. But at the end of the call, both leaders also mentioned that they would like to meet in person for a summit. So there is a sense that both sides would like to talk, even with tensions being high. But it seems like that won't happen anytime soon due to these heavy sanctions from both sides.
The World's Daniel Hoffman, thank you for being on this news.
Thank you very much, Marco.
It seems mainland China is not hitting pause on its crackdown on democracy in Hong Kong. Today, multiple pro-democracy activists and opposition politicians were sentenced in a Hong Kong court, including prominent democracy advocates like Jimmy Lai and Martin Lee. We're joined now by Jeff Wasserstrom, professor at the University of California, Irvine, where he studies modern Chinese history. First of all, Professor, your reaction to these sentences. I mean, these are some high-profile Hong Kongers, and some of them are not young. Are you surprised by any of this?
Well, it's not surprising that it's happened now, the sentencing. It was a surprise a year ago when they were arrested, because it's not just their age, but it's also they were largely seen as moderate figures within the democracy movement. So it was surprising how widespread the crackdown on anybody who has supported even the mildest forms of protests and even the most gradualist moves to try to bring more democracy to Hong Kong, which has never been fully democratic, but all the partially democratic aspects of it have just been hammered away during the last year.
So these two prominent figures who were sentenced today, Jimmy Lai and Martin Lee, remind us who they are.
So Martin Lee, was part of the group of lawyers who actually helped negotiate the deal by which Hong Kong would become part of the People's Republic of China, guaranteeing that it would have some degree of difference from mainland cities once it became part of the PRC in 1997, when it stopped being a British colony. He's a key figure in the democracy movement. I would add a third figure, Margaret Ang, is also just crucially important. She's a highly respected legal force within Hong Kong and another person who's seen as very moderate. Jimmy Lai is more of a firebrand journalist. He's the publisher of the highest profile pro-democracy newspaper. So the three of them really stand out. And Margaret Ang had, I think, the best lines. She read a statement about the fact that the law needs to serve the people, not people be forced to serve the law. And it's a really powerful statement.
Jeff, from where I sit, it seems like some of the younger protesters in Hong Kong have been much more vocal and out in the streets, strategically finding ways to outwit the police, generally more vociferous against Beijing rule in Hong Kong than like the Jimmy Lies. Is there a reason Beijing is going after these higher profile moderates?
So Jimmy Lai has a very powerful voice through Apple Daily, his newspaper, and the whole media group. And so going after him symbolizes going after what's left of freedom of the press in Hong Kong. Going after Margaret Ang, in a sense, is going after what's left of Hong Kong having courts that had a high degree of independence, a legal system that was quite different. You know, I think it's important that the British colonial system, it was never democratic in Hong Kong at all. There were just small places, though, where people could express their views. And there was a high degree of rule of law. On the mainland, it has often been much more rule by law, with the government using law to shape how society works, rather than law being a realm in which people can contest things that the government is doing. So in realm after realm, it's the government trying to rein in the areas of Hong Kong life that could be separate. But you're right, these are not figures who were on the front lines doing the most militant actions during 2019.
I mean, it really seems like many, maybe most of the prominent pro-democracy lawmakers, the protest organizers, the public figures, that they're caught up in the government's crackdown. Many of them now facing jail time. What is left of the movement, the pro-democracy movement at this point?
So the movement, you're right. Anybody who had any degree of kind of leadership who is still in Hong Kong is either in prison or expecting to be in prison soon. The important thing to note is that a fair number of people have gone into exile. And I hate to ever foreclose possibilities because Hong Kong has shown a steady process of making fools of forecasters. It was never supposed to become a great city, and it did. There was a lot of expectation that right after the handover in 1997, it would immediately die and become just like any other mainland city, and yet somehow it managed to preserve a degree of difference. I think it's important not to think of Hong Kong as being dead, but the one country, two systems framework that provided a lot of breathing space for activists there, that I think is dead by moves such as this and the whole last year of moves like it that have been coming.
Jeff Wasserstrom studies modern Chinese history at the University of California, Irvine. We've been speaking about today's sentences of democracy activists and high-profile leaders in Hong Kong. Jeff, thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you very much for talking to me.
In Peru, a crowded field of 18 presidential candidates is now down to two, a schoolteacher and the daughter of a former president. They go to a runoff election in June. Many Peruvians see it as a choice between the far left and the far right. The World's Jorge Valencia reports.
Both candidates were controversial even before they won the first round of presidential voting this week. Pedro Castillo appeared before his supporters in his native rural region of Cajamarca.
Gracias, gracias.
Castillo spoke with no podium, no microphone, just a face mask and a farmer's hat. He said he wanted to thank voters in all of rural Peru, where he said the government has forgotten them. And where we get by on grilled sweet potatoes, Castillo said.
Pido a ustedes no caer en un tipo de provocaciones.
Castillo asked his supporters to not give in to provocation. Because they're waiting for us to make mistakes, he said. 51-year-old Pedro Castillo has mounted the ultimate outsider campaign for president of Peru. 4 years ago, he made a name for himself as the leader of a teacher strike and has tapped into the stark inequalities of rural versus urban Peru. Davy de la Cruz hosts a radio show near Castillo's hometown.
Es una persona humilde, ¿no? Así como nosotros, campesinos, que conoce la realidad.
Castillo is a person of humble origins, like the rest of us farmers, de la Cruz says. He understands our reality.
Hay mucha alegría. Mencionan, tal vez vamos a darle el voto a una persona.
De la Cruz says there's a lot of joy in their part of the country. A lot of people are saying they're going to vote for somebody who is just like them. Meanwhile, Keiko Fujimori, the other candidate advancing to the runoff, spoke from a brightly lit room in the capital of Lima.
Agradecer a todos los peruanos por su valentía.
Wearing a crisp white button-down, Fujimori thanked all Peruvians for voting.
Agradezco a mi familia porque gracias.
And she also thanked her family for their support. Her father, Alberto Fujimori, was president of Peru for all of the 1990s.
Más allá de las diferencias, también hay grandes coincidencias.
Fujimori said she had a lot in common with some of the candidates who lost, like their support for the Constitution, which her father approved in 1993.
Hago una invocación a ellos que creen en un modelo.
She also called on those who believe in free markets and private investment to join her. 45-year-old Keiko Fujimori is making her third run for the presidency. Alonso Cárdenas is a political analyst in Lima. He says Fujimori has promised a heavy hand against crime and a pro-business administration.
Pro-market, less intervention of the state, and privatization of everything almost in Peru. More mines, more gas, more oil, and less regulation, less protection of the environment.
Fujimori advanced to the runoff despite serious corruption accusations. She was briefly in jail and is currently under investigation. Her father was convicted of gross human rights violations during his presidency. Cárdenas says voters who support Keiko Fujimori likely have a nostalgia for a moment in which Alberto Fujimori ended conflict with domestic terrorist groups and ushered the country toward economic growth.
They're always remembering former President Fujimori. So they're like a big fans of his government.
But a lot of Peruvians are unhappy with their choice in the presidential runoff. The two candidates put together got about 30% in the first round of voting. That means something like 70% of voters opposed them. Some say it's like having to choose between AIDS and cancer.
Disappointment, sadness, rage.
Olga Gonzalez is the associate dean at the Global Citizenship Institute at McAllister College in Minnesota. She says she has strong feelings about this election.
Because, well, first of all, because I am Peruvian, what I see is a very chaotic panorama landscape in terms of politics.
Gonzalez says framing this race simply as rich versus poor, urban versus rural, isn't quite right. For example, neither candidate supports same-sex marriage or abortion rights.
These kind of binaries can be problematic, but it does say and speak about how polarized the country is.
Right now, Fujimori and Castillo are making deals with groups that they defeated in the first round, hoping to cobble together enough support to be the first across the finish line this June. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
An update now to a story we've been following here at The World. This afternoon, President Biden changed course on a plan to help refugees. Back in February, Biden pledged to significantly increase the number of refugees admitted to the U.S. to about 62,000 for the rest of this year. We learned today that that figure will remain at 15,000, a historically low number set by the Trump administration. President Biden did sign an order today that will do away with restrictions on refugees who come to the U.S. from Africa, the Middle East, and Central America, but the overall number stays at 15,000. We'll have more on the impact and reaction to President Biden's decision on Monday. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The European Union is expected to release new legislation on artificial intelligence next week, rules around how the technology should be designed and used, and what should not be allowed. It's an ambitious approach to regulating the ever-expanding universe of AI technologies. The World's Lydia Manalidou obtained a draft of the regulations and has this report.
First off, you might be wondering what we mean by artificial intelligence.
This is a notoriously tricky question.
Daniel Lufer is with the digital rights organization Access Now. He says the simple answer is that AI systems follow a set of built-in rules to make automated decisions. One example is facial recognition.
It's making a decision about whether face X matches face Y, or whether the person standing in front of the camera is the same person whose biometric data is contained in their passport.
There are other examples, like some police departments use AI systems to predict crimes. Banks use them to evaluate creditworthiness. Companies to narrow down job candidates. Lufer says these systems are often sold on their effectiveness and efficiency. But
we've seen mounting evidence of how these systems can cause harm.
There was a whole scandal in the Netherlands around the use of algorithmic systems for welfare fraud detection.
Sarah Chander is with the advocacy group European Digital Rights. She's talking about a system the Dutch government deployed to identify people committing welfare fraud. More than 20,000 people were falsely flagged. They lost their benefits, and many were even forced to give back what they'd received.
Bear in mind, this is people in very precarious positions who rely on the state for living and had some really serious consequences.
Dutch officials later admitted the system was singling out people based on their ethnicity and nationality. This is precisely the type of thing the EU wants to prevent through the proposal it's unveiling next week. According to a draft of the regulations reviewed by the World, the European Commission wants to institute bans on certain uses of this technology. For example, it wants to prohibit it from being used for, quote, indiscriminate surveillance.
We're very happy the Commission has acknowledged that there are some uses of AI that are just unacceptable.
But digital rights activists say the language right now is too vague. Lufer with Access Now says he's also concerned about a loophole that would allow public authorities to use the technology for public safety.
That's a very big loophole. Instead of, you know, being a proper prohibition, this provides a legal basis for the use of these systems.
Another part of the proposal says risk assessment systems like the Dutch welfare one would be classified as high risk, meaning that they would be subject to a special approval and oversight process. Predictive policing systems would also fall in this category. Activists say they want stricter controls and even bans on these programs. Research shows they disproportionately impact already marginalized groups like migrants and people of color. They have biases built into them and can exacerbate inequities, discrimination, and racism. Some were surprised that concern was not really reflected in the leaked regulation.
I was shocked because I certainly didn't see it in the document.
Petra Molnar is a lawyer and researcher with the group called the Migration and Technology Monitor.
It's unfortunate that this regulation doesn't take an intersectional historical approach to racism, oppression, systemic discrimination, and the way that tech is playing up those dynamics, particularly in the European space.
But Molnar and other activists are hopeful some of that will change between now and next Wednesday, when the final proposal is expected to be released. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
50 years ago this week, the first official American delegation in decades was invited to China to play ping pong. An unconventional bit of diplomacy, but the match has led to President Richard Nixon's visit the next year and a normalization of U.S.-China relations. Rebecca Canther in Shanghai reports that those games have not been forgotten.
It was 1971 at the Table Tennis World Championships in Tokyo. The Chinese team invited the U.S. team to pop over for an impromptu visit. The overture seemed serendipitous, but it was no accident.
There's something so innately absurd about using ping pong as a form of diplomacy that it's sort of this charming story that we've been leaning on now for 50 years.
That's Nicholas Griffin, author of a book about what's now called ping pong diplomacy. He says the meeting was an intentional move on the part of both governments. The visit captured the imagination of Americans.
Because it was the front cover of Time magazine, it was the Johnny Carson show, you name it, the ping pong players were everywhere. They were the story in America for a couple of weeks in the spring of 71.
The next year, the U.S. invited the Chinese players. A Chinese video captured their arrival.
American people from all walks of life, including table tennis players, as well as members of the Chinese community, come to the airport to welcome the first ambassadors of goodwill sent by the Chinese people to the United States.
The games were billed as friendship first, competition second. Maybe by design, because the U.S. team was no match for the Chinese players. And it worked. China's reputation in the U.S. jumped. Today, relations between the two countries are the worst they've been since 1989, and a reported 90% of Americans have an unfavorable view of China. At a recent ceremony held at the Museum of Ping Pong in Shanghai, Chinese players from the original team appealed for a return to friendlier times, like 74-year-old Yao Zhenxu. Even though these days we're having some difficulties, he says, I hope that our two countries can seek common ground and put our differences aside. We can cooperate or compete as the situation dictates, but always with the goal of peace. Chinese ambassador to the U.S., Cui Tiankai, used his pre-recorded message to call for a cooperation on pandemic response and climate change. But he didn't hold back from criticizing some in the U.S. for antagonism against China. After the ceremony, players and diplomats took off their jackets, rolled up their sleeves, and
let's play ping pong.
Like 50 years ago, the Chinese and Americans put friendship first and competition second on the court. And for just a few hours, it seemed everyone put their faith in the power of a little ball. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
If you caught the show yesterday, you heard about tens of thousands of Australians stranded abroad during the pandemic. That's because Australia limits the number of slots for people returning. A mandatory two-week quarantine is required upon arrival, and space in quarantine hotels is limited. Getting a seat on a flight home is also all about supply and demand. With fewer seats open, the price of a ticket home can cost more than $10,000. To cap things off, stranded Australians also can't sue in Australian courts for re-entry because Australia does not guarantee its citizens the right of return. So last month, a group of them connected to the website freeandopenaustralia.org, they took their cases to the United Nations Human Rights Committee. It can issue non-binding judgments. And late yesterday, it took a rare emergency measure, formally requesting that the Australian government facilitate and ensure the petitioner's prompt return to Australia. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Edison Thiessen is 2 years old and he doesn't yet know how to write, but he has devoted followers. For residents of a retirement center in Toronto, Fridays with Edison has become a must-read.
Getting these letters from Edison is like having a visitor every week.
The old connect with the very young. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. For as long as most Cubans have been alive, their island nation has been ruled by one of two men, both of them named Castro. Fidel rose to power in the 1959 revolution and remained at the helm for nearly half a century, bedeviling 11 U.S. presidents. In fact, it was 60 years ago this weekend that Castro-led forces defeated the U.S.-backed Bay of Pigs invasion, cementing his control over the island.
With the Castro government completely victorious over the invading rebels, there is despair and confusion among the relatives of the insurgents.
In 2006, Fidel passed on the reins to his younger brother, Raul. Today, Raul announced at the opening of the Communist Party Congress that he is stepping down. That means for the first time in decades, Cubans will plan a future without a Castro in charge. Joe Garcia is watching the transition closely. He's a Miami attorney and former member of Congress. His parents fled Cuba after the 1959 revolution. Joe, Cuba's Communist Party is the party there, and as it does every 5 years, it's convening today. But with Raul Castro stepping down his head, is this a moment of real change in Cuba? Is that what you're hearing and seeing?
We shall see, said the wise man, right? the reality is that you're already seeing beginning changes as this party Congress meets. They're going to probably pass on the chairmancy of the Communist Party at this meeting to probably the sitting president, Díaz-Canel. Just yesterday, the head of the military was asked to retire. This is Cuba, where these things, these political reactions to problems are not typical. It's usually a one man who does moves, change things. Now you're seeing them at least trying or appearing to have some type of institutional transition.
Let's talk about the economy, because right now in Cuba, the economy is in ruins. Prior to the pandemic, Cuba could at least count on some tourist money, but the coronavirus has devastated even that. Is the threat of economic collapse or continuing downturns just forcing the regime to open up the state-run economy even more than Raul had done?
Of the two brothers, Raul was the one who allowed slighter changes when the economy was under disastrous conditions. For example, when the Soviet bloc collapsed and the Soviet Union stopped subsidizing Cuba. In the latter part of that crisis, which was called by Castro the special period, Raul began to allow small market changes. You're absolutely right. The economic condition in Cuba is disastrous, and it's going from bad to worse. This is a country which imports over 70% of its foodstuffs. Quite literally, for the last year, it's been on lockdown. No tourism. What they are facing is probably one of the worst economic times since the special period. But you have seen something that is remarkable. Not only is the president aggressively speaking about loosening controls and pushing production into private hands, he also makes some very communistic speeches while he's doing it, right? So he's trying to do both, because there is still in Cuba a small but significant contingent of people in power who believe in this system that has failed in every way except in keeping them in power.
So for the Cubans you're in touch with, what kinds of economic reforms are they hoping for?
The biggest change that we've seen in the past half century happened during the Obama opening. And you saw businesses, restaurants, particularly as people started visiting the country. And what the government did was about a year and a half ago, they announced that there were 200 jobs that people could do privately. They were trying to put into law what was already happening, but it was very limited. And so less than a month ago, the Cuban government issued a list of almost 2,000 different types of jobs that you could do independently. Clearly, that part of the economy is growing, even under these difficult circumstances.
So the process of normalizing relations between the U.S. and Cuba that began under Obama, let's not forget the Rolling Stones famously played in Havana with this pivot. President Trump, of course, rolled that process back. Does Biden have any intention of extending an olive branch, of re-reversing things?
I think Biden made some basic promises, which he's going to keep, right? He's going to take off the remittance caps. He's probably going to expand travel again. We're headed in the right direction. But to be quite honest, the only reason that there is an embargo against Cuba is because Cuban Americans want it to be there. We've got to try to figure out a way to expand the relationship between Cuban Americans and the Cuban people. And I think that's where you have some hope of changing U.S. policy.
Well, Jill Garcia, you're in Miami, and your own transformation is an interesting one, from executive director of the Cuban American National Foundation, a group that historically took a hardline stance on isolating Cuba, to becoming the first Cuban American Democratic member of Congress from Florida. You favored more openness between the U.S. and Cuba. What did you learn along the way?
Any politician trying to make the argument that, you know, 50 more years and then we'll have them, right, is ridiculous, right? The embargo has not worked. And so after working very assiduously on this side of that debate, I decided that I had to have a broader vision. And I think when Obama did his opening and when John Kerry, the Secretary of State, went to raise the American flag at the embassy, I traveled there. I traveled there with my daughter. To some degree, you realize that while I may not agree with the communist government and I may have a historic memory that sets me apart from what governs Cuba, our policy is not only not having an effect, but it's hurting the Cuban people, not the government. The government is firmly in control. And so what we have to try to do is figure out a way where we can help the Cuban people help themselves. And I'm a big believer in expanding civil society, expanding private enterprise, investing in people. And to some degree, I've been involved in that now for a while. And I think it's having impact.
Joe Garcia is an attorney and former member of Congress, speaking with us from Miami about the political transition happening in Cuba. Joe, thanks very much for being with us today.
It was a pleasure, Marco.
The program that allows Cuban-American families to reunite with loved ones on the island, it's been on pause since 2017. Reporter Danny Rivera with WLRN in Miami has been following the situation. Danny, help us understand, why is this program still on hold?
So it all boils down to the mysterious sonic attacks that happened at the U.S. Embassy in Havana towards the end of 2017. They also happened at the Canadian Embassy in Havana. Nobody's really been able to get to the bottom of what those attacks were, where they came from. But the Trump administration, on the heels of those attacks, put the program on hold and pulled out almost all of the staff from the U.S. Embassy. So basically, consular services at the U.S. Embassy in Havana have not been taking place. If you want a visa to come to the U.S., you want to get an interview for a visa, you're not able to do that in the whole island of Cuba at this point.
So what are families expected to do if the U.S. Embassy in Havana is closed? Like, who can they call?
So the U.S. State Department is actually asking Cuban families to go to a third country for processing, and the U.S. Embassy that they've designated for that processing for Cubans stuck in this is Guyana. So the federal government is asking these families to travel to Guyana to go to the embassy to do their interviews there. And Guyana is not easy to get to from Cuba. Cuba has very low wages. It's proven very difficult for people to go there. And there's an estimated 22,000 people that are stuck in this situation, that going to Guyana is the only chance that they might have to be able to come to the U.S.
Right, which means that the cost of that just went up by a round-trip plane ticket to Guyana. You've spoken with families that want to bring a son or a parent to the U.S., Danny. What have they told you about having to wait like this?
Right, there's a lot of them. There's many, many thousands just here in Florida alone. So one of the people I talked to was Marieta Medialdea. She paid for her son to come through this program. She registered him in 2016 when he was 13 years old. And now he's about to turn 18 years old. So she's actually really scared that he's going to be forced to serve in the Cuban military, because military conscription is mandatory there. And she's scared of that. And as a result, she's asking the Biden administration to reopen the embassy, or at least reopen some of these basic services.
Porque lo hemos hecho de la manera que nos los han pedido, por la que hemos pagado, y eso es lo que pedimos.
So Marieta says that she's already paid for the process. You know, to get into this program, families actually do have to pay in, and that's to do the processing, and that processing hasn't happened yet. And she says in order to go to Guyana, she would have to go with her son since he's underage, and that means the cost of it would just double, which she's not able to actually pay for. She doesn't have that much money. And I also met Nubis Robaina. She's a Cuban born here in Miami, and she and her family were very, very close to reuniting with her cousin, aunt, and uncle, who are in Cuba now. And this is what she had to say.
They went on an interview. They were approved. They have a paper saying, welcome to the United States of America. Come back to pick your visa on next month. They closed the embassy, and all of their documents are in there for over 3 years.
Wow, so over 3 years and not really anyone to call about this. So they've been living in limbo, essentially. Have there been any consequences to keeping the embassy closed and the reunification program on hold this long?
So keep in mind that Cuba is a surveillance state. So when people on the island make it publicly known that they don't like the government, that they want to leave, they're basically put on a blacklist for work on the island. And they're closely watched by government functionaries. So Robaina, for instance, told me that her family is not just stuck, they've been stuck basically at home under the thumb, not been able to work, to study, and under the constant eye of this authoritarian government.
So do we expect the Biden White House to help out? I mean, will Biden reopen the U.S. Embassy's consular services in Havana?
So the Biden administration has launched its own investigation into these mysterious sonic attacks. They hope to get to the bottom of that. And there's a lot of pressure coming from some parts of the Cuban-American community here to, whether they find answers or not, just come up with a solution. One thing to keep in mind is that the closing of the embassy happened just after the embassy opened in the first place. The U.S. reestablished diplomatic relations in 2015 when Biden was vice president, and the U.S. hasn't even named an ambassador to that country. So in some sense, he's facing pressure to actually normalize the relations, which were never truly normalized in the first place.
That's Danny Rivero, reporter at WLRN in Miami, speaking with us about the possibility for Cuban-American and Cuban families to reunite. Danny, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Authorities in Pakistan today briefly pulled the plug on social media networks after several days of violent protests by a radical Islamist group. They're angry about what they see as blasphemy against their religion, specifically the depiction of the Prophet Muhammad in Western satirical cartoons. Several police officers have been killed in these protests. It's the kind of deadly clash between politics and religion that I.A. Rahman would have had opinions about. He's known as the father of human rights in Pakistan. Rahman died this week of natural causes at the age of 90. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports on his legacy.
In modern Pakistan, I.A. Rahman was an unlikely figure who, for years, opposed dictators, supported secular democracy, and fought for the rights of religious minorities and women.
And these are subjects that if you talk openly about in Pakistan, you're a target. You know, you can be killed, you can be attacked.
Taha Siddiqui is a journalist who says he was forced to flee Pakistan after being physically attacked in 2018. Now living in Paris, he says, despite the danger, Rahman was one of the most persistent and vocal advocates for equality in Pakistan.
For all of us, he was kind of a mentor, someone who inspired all of us to be someone like him.
Rahman was born in northern India to a family he later described as both secular and Muslim. Rahman said that as a high schooler, he didn't know the difference between Hindus and Muslims. But when he was 17, India went through partition and his family migrated to Pakistan. Rahman started writing for the Pakistan Times, a revered institution. He became part of a prominent group of journalists and human rights activists. Marvi Sermed's father was also part of that group. She grew up with Rahman as an uncle.
It was early 1950s. That was the era of ideologies.
Sermed says Rahman was part of the first generation of intellectuals and activists of the new nation of Pakistan, driven to preserve its founding ideals. Together with prominent human rights lawyer Usman Jahangir, Rahman co-founded the Independent Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, or HRCP. It remains a powerful force in the country.
HRCP would not have been the kind of institution it is today had it not been for Rahman Uncle. It was like his baby.
Sermed, a human rights advocate herself, says Rahman helped preserve the ideas of freedom and human rights as Pakistanis adjusted to life under one dictator after another.
We wouldn't have known what is right and what is wrong because my generation, the schools were working under oppression. The media had completely Islamized. So we wouldn't have known the light of the truth had these people not been there.
Rahman was a columnist for the English-language newspaper Dawn. In recent years, he argued that the Pakistani government was using its nuclear weapons to hold on to political power. Rahman also bemoaned the disappearances and detentions of journalists and human rights activists.
He was very upset about it. I haven't seen him so perturbed about the tactics of the state ever.
Rahman died on Monday. Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi tweeted that the country had lost a true icon who had championed tolerance, inclusion, equality, and dignity. Rahman's death comes 3 years after that of his Human Rights Commission co-founder, Usman Jahangir. The loss of these two towering figures, Marvi Sermet says, has been devastating.
This entire generation, I mean, oh God, we have been dreading this. We always thought that these people are so giant. What will we do without them?
We often talk about this in Pakistan, that who are the next, you know, Asma Jahangirs or the I.A. Rahmans, and we don't see any.
Taha Siddiqui, the journalist in Paris, says it's not easy for activists today to follow in their footsteps and stand up to the Pakistani government.
There are very few of them left, and very few of them in this current generation, and very few we see in the future who would become another I.A. Rahman or another Asma Jahangir or another of these names that we look up to.
Siddiqui says that's the deeply troubling challenge Pakistani human rights advocates face. For now, though, they'll mourn and honor I.A. Rahman's legacy. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
This is music from Cambodia's wild psychedelic period in the 1960s and early 70s. On this day in 1975, the Khmer Rouge marched into the Cambodian capital, Phnom Penh, and stamped out most forms of Western music. A lot of artists tried to flee the country or were sent to re-education camps. Many were murdered by the brutal regime of dictator Pol Pot. This band is Drakkar. Some of Drakkar's own members did not survive the Khmer Rouge. Somehow, this cassette did. a demo tape of the band was only unearthed less than 10 years ago, during a renaissance of the music that was made prior to the Khmer Rouge. Psychedelic rock that was never released in Cambodia, it remains an artifact of musical possibility during deadly oppression. From the past to the present, from changes in Cuba to political intrigue from Russia, start your morning with a quick hit of news stories from around the globe. Our team at The World will send it right to your email inbox so you can start the day informed. Sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World, on our website, theworld.org/newsletters. Again, that's theworld.org/newsletters. You want to talk about COVID vaccine success? Look to Bhutan, the little kingdom wedged between India and China. It took just 1 week for the country to vaccinate almost their entire adult population. Bhutan's success is discussed in The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at Economist Radio. Max Rodenbeck runs the Economist South Asia Bureau in Delhi. Rodenbeck told host Jason Palmer that credit goes not only to Bhutan's political leaders, but also to the kingdom's Buddhist monks, because they recommended who should get the first shot.
The important thing was that the very first vaccination dose should be given to a woman born in the year of the monkey by another woman born in the year of the monkey.
And so that's how it played out. Authorities waited until the stars were aligned, as it were.
Yes, indeed. They received the first vaccines in January, but waited until the end of March to start administering them. The kingdom had all of its adult population register to take the shot and then judged that about 85% of those people really needed the shot. And within a single week, they managed to vaccinate just about all of that 85% of the population.
And is that just down to the country's small population?
It's a small population, but it's a very mountainous country. It's difficult to reach them all. It's due to a lot of things. I mean, for one thing, the king of Bhutan, for example, some years ago set up a group of volunteers called the Guardians of Peace, who sort of, they wear orange jumpsuits and they leap into action whenever there's a kind of national project. They're sort of public service volunteers, kind of national service corps that's ready to work for this kind of thing. And in the case of the vaccination campaign, they served a very important role. There's also, you know, political leaders such as the health minister, Dechen Wangmo, who is an epidemiologist with very top degrees from the U.S. So they have actually been extremely vigorous in their response to the COVID pandemic from the very beginning. You know, the strict quarantine measures for anyone arriving from outside, they've actually virtually cut off all tourism arriving in the country. And for example, in March, the king himself spent a week in quarantine just after having visited a few provinces in the south of the country.
But having been willing to wait a couple of months to start, why such a focus on speed once they started?
Well, the Prime Minister, Mr. Chering, who's really gone all out on fighting COVID, his Facebook page is almost entirely devoted for the last few months to the vaccination campaign, to have everyone sort of worked into a national project to make it all happen at once.
That's Max Rodenbeck and host Jason Palmer in a recent episode of the Intelligence podcast from our partners at Economist Radio. To hear more, check out The Intelligence wherever you download your podcasts. Finally today, Edison's story. In Canada, one two-year-old and his mom wanted to bring a little joy to the residents at a retirement home. As we all know, the pandemic and social isolation has been especially tough on residents in retirement homes pretty much everywhere. As The World's Bianca Hillier reports, a little personal connection in Toronto has gone a long way.
When the pandemic hit, Chrissy Kelton knew she had to do something to help the residents at the retirement community where she works in downtown Toronto.
A big thing that they were feeling was that lack of one-on-one connection with their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren. It was undeniably challenging.
Kelton works at the Chartwell Avondale Retirement Residence, and this pain was weighing on her, too. So she called a longtime friend, Maylin Thiessen, to brainstorm.
In one of our many conversations, we were trying to come up with a way that we could lighten their mood or give them something to look forward to. And I'm sitting here looking at Edison.
Edison is Thiessen's son. He was just one at the time, so he couldn't really talk and certainly couldn't write. But Thiessen and Kelton thought maybe the residents would want to hear from him.
And so the idea was, let's bring Edison to the residents.
That idea turned into a weekly newsletter called Fridays with Edison. From more than 200 miles west in Kingsville, Ontario, Edison's mom, Thiessen, started writing from her son's perspective about all the little things he played with and observed throughout the week.
It's all I this, I that, right from a one-year-old's mouth, but written by me.
She tacked on a few photos and sent it off to Kelton, who printed the newsletter and delivered it to the retirement home's 70 residents. It was an instant hit.
Oh, well, I've really enjoyed Fridays with Edison.
Jesse Kerr Lawson has been an avid fan of the newsletter since the very first edition. She says his letters helped her most when COVID safety measures were at their strictest.
His mother was describing things that he looked at as he was walking along, and so it was almost as if we were going on a little walk with him. It was great to have this sort of experience of being outside almost, even though you weren't.
Kerr Lawson has never met Edison, lives hundreds of miles away, and is 90 years older than him. Still, she relates to the little guy.
Do I think I feel as if I know him? Yes, I do. We'd have quite a pleasant chat if he turned up in the front lobby someday. Sure, we'd have lots to talk about.
That conversation is already underway. Kerr Lawson is one of a handful of residents who have started writing back to Edison. Another one of Edison's pen pals is Arlene Davis.
He is a delightful, feisty-looking little redhead. Getting these letters from Edison is like having a visitor every week.
One of the letters that stuck with Davis talked about the time Edison tried his first radish.
You know, radishes are an acquired taste, and Edison hasn't acquired that taste yet.
Specifically, that newsletter read, "Remember when I told you I was going to be able to try a radish soon? I got to do that this week. I actually liked it at first, but then it got spicier as I bit closer to the leaves. I made a scrunched up face when that happened." Stories like that, Davis says, remind her of her own childhood when she, too, would rummage around in the garden. Many of Edison's adventures happen outside, which is exactly where I found him when I called his mom, Maylin Thiessen, this week.
Hi, Edison. I'm talking to a new friend.
Thiessen got down to Edison's level in their garden and put me on speakerphone while she asked him about his friends in Toronto.
Do you like sending those newsletters? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then when your friends write you mail, do you like getting that mail?
Yeah.
And where do we get the mail?
In mailbox.
Yeah. Do you use the key?
Edison quickly became more interested in some nearby rhubarb than in a stranger on the phone.
Can you please say bye to our new friend?
Bye.
Back at the retirement community in Toronto, Jesse Kerr Lawson hopes Edison won't say bye to her anytime soon.
I am really pleased that he's keeping on writing, that he hasn't got bored with us old people. So it's very nice to be getting them from him.
Edison's ghostwriter, his mom, says the residents have nothing to worry about. Even as COVID restrictions ease up and their own families can visit again, the newsletters will continue to arrive. Each one signed, Love, Edison. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Don't stop ghostwriting, Edison. You can see photos of Edison and read a few of his newsletters on our website, theworld.org. I promise you won't be disappointed. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, have a great weekend.